Welcome back to Historical Homos, the world's only no-fucks-given guide to queer history. Today, my drag kings and queens and in-betweens, we return to France to celebrate a much-overlooked artist, genderbender, woman who definitely fucked, cigar smoker, pants wearer, top hat toter, and get this, self-made writer. That's it, ladies and gentlemen, a woman making money from writing. In the 19th century. It can't be done! Oh, but it can, and it done did. For I am speaking, mais bien sûr, of George Sand, a fantastically successful and celebrated writer in her own day, who rubbed shoulders and genitals with the greatest names of her era. Victor Hugo, Flaubert, Delacroix, Chopin, Musset, I could go on, but I think I've demonstrated the quality of my French accent. Georges was a radical thinker and scandalous fixture of French society throughout her long, illustrious life. She was a feminist and proto-gender theorist in a century that punished and belittled women at every turn. She was a free-loving bisexual in a country where, actually, people seem to have been free-loving bisexuals for quite some time, so that wasn't that radical. But above all, she was a writer who also happened to be a woman, as her detractors and supporters never ceased to remind her. She wrote over 70 novels and plays and was widely read and celebrated from her very first publications. Georges wrote prolifically and tirelessly, while also raising her two children, advocating for workers' and women's rights, getting laid constantly, and of course, administering her family's ancestral estate. God, I wish someone would give me one of those. But how did Aurore Dupin, the French country girl, become George Sand, the cosmopolitan capital H-E-R, who took Paris and its most famous penises by storm? How did the world around her react to her bisexual love affairs, as exalted as they were numerous? And why is her work less remembered than her male counterparts? It's time to figure it all out. So jump into your gender-fluid galoshes and prepare to get soaked, because the water is what? Human temperature.
So let's go back in time and take another rewrite through our history. H-O-M-O. Celebrate ourselves tonight and cover all the things that's still a mystery. H-O-M-O. Cause if you think you know you don't.
First, I want to welcome our very special guest, Léa Desgarais. Léa, am I pronouncing that correctly?
C'était parfait. It was perfect. Oh,
parfait, parfait. Léa is a writer, actor, playwright, and today she will be our resident expert in all things George Sand. So, Léa, tell us a little about yourself. Who are you? What do you do? Who do you fuck?
Get in there. Hello, I'm so excited to be here. I'm a huge fan of Historical Homo, so thank you for having me. And I was born in Bordeaux in France. Full of wine and cheese and gorgeous things, and was destined to be an academic for a little while until, as part of my English master's at the École Normale Supérieure, I came to teach French at Cambridge University, UK. And
very chic.
Very chic. And I got completely swallowed up, not by my degree or my teaching, sorry, but by theatre. And I decided to move to London to be an actor. And actually, it turns out I could marry my passion and my degree.
Well, listen, I'm glad you got out. Because academia threatens to swallow us all. But
right?
It's not the answer. Just because we love books and we love school doesn't mean academia is the answer. You can use your academic passions in the real world. I believe that firmly. That is why this podcast
exists. Yeah, I thought I wanted to really go away from academia for a while, and then with this, with George, with the play about George Sand, I got thrown right straight back into it and straight back into research. So
tell us about the play. Tell us about Georges, your new play that you put on in London already and which will be put on again in London this coming June.
We were lucky to have a West End showcase through the Criterion New Writing Program in November, but the show in its entirety is still to take over the London stage.
Tell us about how you came to the idea, how you came to be obsessed with Georges Sand. Oh. And tell us a little bit. We'll talk more about it at the end. So let's just start with a little bit about the genesis and what you've produced so far.
Wow. Okay. Well, I was just an actor for a long time and I really didn't want to write. And then as a queer person and wanting to also perform roles of French people who are not necessarily labeled, you know, the sexy French lady with an accent like this, I started to dive into French figures and I remember George Sand. I had studied her at school, and I remembered vaguely that she dressed as a man, smoked cigars, as you said, and also that she was quite free sexually. And so I was like, "Oh, let me check her again."
This sounds like me.
What do you mean? No. Yes. And actually, yeah, when I re-dived into her life, not only she was so much more than what I had been taught to believe, or what's in that kind of like the social consciousness in France and beyond. And I started reading this biography that we had back home in Bordeaux. I think I started that in like 2019, so quite a while back. And I was like, I kept reading and I thought, whoa, like she says things that I think. She's putting words to my thoughts, which was really exciting. And I often say I found a soul sister 2 centuries apart, but it also made me think, oh, well, now I have to write about it.
So annoying to find yourself in history, because then you have to write about it.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, oh, damn. But I also, honestly, also, you know, I don't know if it's selfish or what, but I also thought I'd love to play her as an actor. Like, she's the epitome of a free spirit beyond gender, beyond binary. And I wanted to share her story. It took me a while to find the angle for the play, though, because I wanted to say so many things about her. I mean, we'll talk about her in more detail, but there were so many interesting things about her life that I wanted to write about, you know?
And lots of different phases of her life, it feels like.
Yeah.
Like, she played a lot of characters throughout her life, it seemed to me, in doing the research that I did for this. Okay, well, let's dive into it. So that the listeners can hear about this fantastic figure. Act 1, the beginning and end of Mademoiselle Amantine Lucille Aurore Lain de Franqueuil. Now, Léa, we are starting in early 19th century France, really. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I forgot her name. So Georges Sand lived from 1804 to 1876. Mm-hmm. And it's a crazy century, right? Like, there's a lot that goes on in France. They had also just had a crazy end to the previous century. Mm-hmm. So I think it would be helpful for us to just give our listeners a little bit of an overview of the stuff that's going on, and especially what impact it had on women. I mean, I actually, I think we think about the French Revolution as a difficult time for everyone, but there were some amazing advancements made for women.
Yeah.
It was the first time that women were given the right to own property in France, for example. That was then swiftly taken away in the early 19th century by Napoleon's civil code. Mm-hmm. And that really set off a century of women being treated as legal and, you know, effective minors in the
Absolutely.
Eyes of society. So talk to us a little bit about, like, what happened, what was going on for women in that time in early 19th century France, and how that might have impacted Aurore.
Well, like you said, the Napoleon Code Civil in 1804 basically made women men's property after having had quite a large advancement, and just established married women as legal minors. And also, for example, in the case of Georges Sand later on in her life, gave all your possessions to your husband. And this is something that Georges will fight against her whole life: women's independence, women's equality with men. And I think we'll dive more into that. But also, she she has a really big duality, which is influenced by this. So the 19th century is madness in France. You have a huge social, industrial, political change. You have seven regimes, one after the other, over the course of George Sand's life. So it's chaotic, but it also means that a lot is possible, that you have new ideas, that you can have, yeah, a good soil for the birth of this queering the norm, I guess, that gave her a lot of possibilities and also something to rebel against with this civil code. And so when she arrives in the world, she's actually the daughter of an aristocratic man and a woman of the people, as she calls her. So she will constantly have this duality in her life, and is very representative of her political combat throughout the century as well, and everything that's been going on since the 18th century, you know, the aristocracy being slightly overtaken and then just trying desperately to take the power back between the Republic, monarchy, and the Empire. So that's like very chaotic also as a presentation, but there's a lot.
No, I think that's exact. I want it to be chaotic because it is chaotic. I mean, as you said, there are, let me just count them. There are seven regimes. So you have the Empire with the first Empire with Napoleon, uh-huh. Which is done in 1815. And then the monarchs are restored, Louis XVIII and Charles X. And so they last until 1830. Then you have another monarchy that replaces that. That's a more constitutional monarchy, mm-hmm. from that lasts until 1848. Then that gets superseded by the Second Republic.
Absolutely.
Which is fairly short-lived, because Napoleon III comes around with his second empire, mm-hmm. which lasts for, I mean, nothing lasts longer than like 20 years, basically, mm-hmm. Until you finally get to the Third Republic, which is proclaimed in 1870, but it's very tricky because you have the Paris Commune and in 1871, and it's all a mess. So, I mean, the Third Republic lasted until 1940, but still, this is seven regime changes all within her, pretty much the exact boundaries of her of her lifetime, right?
And she arrived just after the end of the First Republic. It had just arrived and then whoosh, got swept away. So she,
right?
Yeah. And I guess that's also, yeah, what's rooted her fight throughout her life. And she'll fight for the Republic to come back again and again and again. And thankfully it did before she passed away, which is nice.
And there's a lot going on in terms of early feminism as well in this century,
yeah.
right? Like, even though women are seen legally as, you know, minors and perhaps still intellectually as inferiors to men.
Absolutely.
There's a lot, there's, you know... I know Georges Sand launched her own newspaper eventually when she was very political. I mean, women are writing, women are talking about women's rights. I know, and Georges Sand also opposed women's suffrage. Isn't that true?
Yes, she did.
Until they could be better educated.
Yeah, because her idea was, a lot of people later on said, oh, Georges Sand was great, but she opposed human suffrage. No, she opposed vote for women, and actually she didn't. She just said, wait, before you give them a civil right, give them the status of actual citizens, so give them
right.
an education and allow them to have equal chances before you put the suffrage between their hands. Because she said what's going to happen eventually is that women will just reproduce their husbands / fathers / male tutors' views, and that will be useless. And also, you know, to her, vote of the right vote also came from educating, and whether it is women and the people. To her, the equality of women between women and men also came on with an equality nation-wise, you know, also between
yeah.
different classes. It was also a class fight. So it was all tied together, and she had a really thorough understanding of what needed to happen in her society, and that she knew couldn't happen in her lifetime, but she really sowed the seeds for that.
Yeah. She's quite the little socialist princess,
yeah,
actually.
Absolutely.
Which we love. Our little lefty queen. So, okay, let's talk a little bit more about her childhood, because it's really interesting. Like you said, she was kind of a mixture of high and low. She was also, you know, because this is a podcast celebrating queer women, we always start with astrology. She was born July 1st, 1804, making her a Cancer, which I looked up and means that she was fundamentally sensitive, nurturing, and gentle. That sounds accurate. Her emotions,
ruled by her emotions. Yep.
Yes, her emotions may have seemed like a burden, but they were deeply intense, and she felt them very intensely. And she was very committed to her relationships. Oh, honey, was she ever? And she was always very generous and good to people she cared about. So, I thought that was pretty accurate.
That's actually really accurate. Thank you, CoStar.com. She was also really ruled by what she calls her dark cloud, like her spleen, for the whole all of her life, and apparently it's a big Cancer trait. Hope we're not getting any Cancer hatred, but yes, it's a big thing.
I love Cancers. My dad was a Cancer. They're always very like artsy, emotional people, I think. So her father was Captain Maurice François Dupin, and her mother was Antoinette Sophie Victoire de la Borde. Now, her father is interesting because he came from quite an exalted family, right? I mean, they were effectively, I think they were related to royalty through some illegitimate ties. And then on the complete flip side, her mother was a former lady of the streets. Is that going too far?
A dancer is often what they would say, for example.
A dancer. Sure.
A dancer.
You are a whore, darling.
No, I'm not.
Wink, 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 air quote, air quote.
Yes. And she was actually the daughter of an oiselier, so someone who takes care of birds, which is also something that George will take into her stride.
Much more of a woman
of the people, let's say.
Yes. Very interesting combination. And then she also was, she went through a lot as a child, right? I mean, her father dies when she's quite young, and then her brother follows in quick succession. I'm not sure if that was the right order.
Yeah, it's the son first and then the father, I believe.
Right, her little like baby brother, and then her father dies in a riding accident or something, injury.
Yeah, he dies on the Nohant estate, which is the estate that George Sand will end up inheriting, and which is from her father's side, and it's the 13th poplar in the alleyway. She talks about it a lot in her writing, because sometimes even in her youth she would ride wildly to that tree and imagine, you know, kind of put herself in danger riding in her trousers, and reimagining with a lot of romanticism in it, you know, reimagining her father's dying, and it was actually quite heartbreaking for her grandmother as well, the grandmother who later on, when she grew up, kept calling her Maurice and kept, you know, seeing her son in her granddaughter, which I think probably queered up our little Aurore quite early on.
Well, yeah, nothing like some daddy issues to drive you into the arms of all of those fabulous French intellectuals as well. But she also clearly had mommy issues, because this grandmother who was her father's mother was more of an aristocrat, or from that, you know, level of society, and clearly looked down on this woman of the streets, this dancer who had captivated her son. I mean, they were only married 4 weeks before Georges was born, right? And it was kept secret until after Georges was born, and all this stuff. So it's a very it's not a very sort of like open and accepting family situation that she's born into. And eventually the mother is pushed out, right? Of the picture by the grandmother. The grandmother is like, you're not going to raise my child with all of your birds and your prostitution. We are going back to the family estate, and I will do it myself.
Absolutely. It means that little Aurore experiences the injustices of class division from a really young age, and also experiences her first breakup. She describes it like that in her autobiography. Mm. It's her first big rupture, and it is the moment where her mother is going away. And also she found out later that she got a bit of money from the grandmother to let go of her daughter, and that the mother chose
the money.
Yeah. So that's always quite hard to start
Damn.
With.
Damn. What? Once a hoe, always a hoe. get the money first. Poor little Aurore.
Sorry, Sophie Victoire.
Yeah, well, whatever. She fucked up, it sounds like. Yeah, sure. Although I probably wouldn't want to stay around with this rich bitch who hated me in the family estate. But okay, so let's talk a little bit about the grandmother. The grandmother is fascinating. She seems like quite the diva. She was a grandmother in the early 19th century, so she really grew up in the 18th century and was very steeped in Enlightenment ideals. She had read Rousseau. She was eager to raise her child in this, according to some of these ideals. So she gave Aurore a fantastic education, as I understand.
Yeah, she did. She really wanted her to be learned, and she actually herself, read to her a lot. And she also decided to have Deschartres, who was George Sand's father's tutor, she decided to have him teach Aurore as well. And he taught her like a boy after the recommendations of the grandmother. So meaning he taught her practical things, which like Latin and Greek, which felt really practical at the time. Philosophy, history, things that were not taught to young women at the time, which is something that I talk about in the play as well. That's also George's unknown intellectual privilege to have been given these tools from a young age. And yeah, her grandmother wanted her to be able to be also une femme du monde, a woman of the world, and understand what was going on and think for herself.
Right. I think it's so interesting how in history, when you almost invariably, and maybe there is an aristocratic like sort of tinge to this too, but like women who have accomplished things in history, like always get, they always say they were educated like a boy. In a very rare instance, given all of the intellectual privileges, as you put it, of young men. And it's just like, yeah, this is what happens when you educate women. They actually become smart and powerful.
That's literally what she said later on in her writing as well. She's like, if you give the same education to men and women, ta-da, they might actually end up doing the same thing, which is also what she does in the play that I write about in my play. So my George is about George writing one of her works in 1839 about this young woman who was raised as a boy but doesn't know she was born a woman, and performs perfectly in the world as a young aristocrat. And we see a lot of George Sand in that, because she was the perfect young gentleman. And actually we realize that sex does not matter, as it happens, sex as it was, understood at the time.
Yeah. I think it's fascinating. And also, why would you want to raise mothers to be stupid? Do you know what I mean? If women's entire role is to be like the stewards of their children and bring them up right, like I actually never realized that until now. Like, why wouldn't they have thought, oh, maybe we should educate them so that they? I guess because when they did educate them, they became too smart for their own good.
Maybe that's because they would see a threat in the system instantly. I wonder if they even had that reflection. That's a really good question.
Yeah. So anyway, she does get a fantastic education. Mm-hmm. She is also encouraged. She's allowed to roam free on the family estate. She learns the local dialect, which is Berrichon. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, because she's in Le Berry. The Nohant estate is in the region of the Berry.
And where is that exactly in France? In relation to Paris, that's the only place that anyone knows.
It's southwest of Paris. Southwest
of Paris. Okay, so she's running around in this gorgeous estate. She's hanging out with all of the little village children, and she actually gets into a few too many scrapes, and her grandmother sends her off to the convent as a teenager, right?
She sends her to the Couvent des Dames Augustines Anglaises. Couvent des Anglaises. So she goes from there for 4 years, so from the age... Well, no, not 4 years, 2 years? Wait, 14 to 16, 2 years, maths. And she actually has kind of a strange religious epiphany, which she talks about in her autobiography. She becomes sort of exalted in this convent religiously to the point where her grandmother actually becomes concerned and calls her back. It's not only for that, you know, she finishes her time there as well in her studies, but I think there was a real concern regarding young Aurore's tendency to go straight for the adoration of God. You know, she was not an in-between, weirdly, even though she was quite...
She's being extreme.
Yeah, she's being extreme in her godly adorations whilst at the convent. It's like she discovers this calling for God.
God, she just can't do anything right, can she?
No, she... And it's just, it's so crazy because she, just like she, you know, hashtag Cancerian, but she feels intensely all the time.
So then she grows up, she meets the Baron Casimir du Devant. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about him. She gets married to this guy and things go sour quickly.
Yeah, she gets married to him in 1822. So she's still, you know, quite young. She's 18. And she, I think she found, you know, in him something of, I don't know, safety. Also, her grandmother had passed away the year before. And I think, well, first in the eyes of society, she was in need of a tutor now. So she needed a husband. And she, yeah, I think she was, she found that she probably needed this sort of structure, but she faced a lot of challenges in this marriage. I think originally Casimir is seen as this quite bonhomme man, meaning quite well-spirited and quite nice, and she's happy to marry him, but then quite quickly he has different adventures with house staff and
a great, that, what a lovely euphemism.
I don't know how you would and so you know, he just shags all the female servants and then is actually quite violent in his, not, he's not as violent as he will become later. But oh, wow. He shows signs of imbalance and unhealthy red flags. And he, you know, and Georges, well, Aurore at the time, still realizes that he doesn't share her interest in literature or anything. And also, he is not, he's the one in charge of the estate now as her husband. And he really is not a businessman, and so he is doing quite a lot of damage to the estate visually, physically, tearing apart the nature that Georges and her grandmother loved so much, and also quite bad at keeping the books. So he's not a great figure in her life.
Whereas she had been raised literally to do all of that, even though she was a girl, her grandmother raised her to run the estate.
Absolutely, absolutely. She was raised as a businessman, and that's why she handled her finances so well. But I think also this terrible marriage is also what prompted her to her career. But I don't want to jump ahead.
Yeah,
too much, but yeah.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
So before we get to Georges Sand's emancipation and her much more fun career without her boring Philistine husband, she's also a mother. She becomes a mother quite early on, right, in her life. Or I suppose it was, you know, probably too late in that period. They were like, you're 18, you should have 16 children by now. But she has two children, Solange, her daughter, and Maurice, her son. Who are they? How does she feel as a mother for someone who has such strong views about women eventually and you know, an early sort of feminist critique in the back of her mind? What is her early experience as a mother?
Well, her early experience is quite consistent with what happens also later on, which means that people might say in spite of, but I don't think that's the case. She's queering expectations already by actually being a happy mother. She loves being a mother. She's an excellent mother, and she's quite a big mother figure for a lot of people throughout her life afterwards, including her lovers, which is problematic in itself. But with her children already, so she adores her children. Maurice is born first in 1823, and then you have Solange in 1828. And she wants them to have the best upbringing, the best education as well, you know, following in her grandmother's footsteps. And that's the kind of beginning of her mothering. She is also already queering her children in a way that is criticized. So she is, you know, dressing Solange as a boy, like she was dressed as a boy because it was more practical to run through the fields, would you believe? And then she also, like, she comments on Maurice's feminine traits. So she's seeing already that, you know, gender doesn't really matter in her household. And she will stay close to Maurice her whole life, actually collaborating with him in her work, because he was a drawer, a really talented one. She was really close to, he did a lot of illustration of her own works, especially the later works. When
wasn't she also a drawer? Like, didn't she also develop that skill?
Absolutely, she did. She did, and she thought she could make a living from that originally at first. She was a really talented drawer. And Maurice married quite late. She was a bit worried still. But she just wanted to see him happy. And Maurice's wife will be a big, big advocate for son's work afterwards. So the relationship with Maurice was, you know, sometimes like parent-child relationship had its ups and downs, but was quite consistent and loving, and they were quite close. Whereas the relationship with Solange was a bit more chaotic and a bit actually quite difficult at times. Growing up, there's no mention of it being bad growing up, but when she starts to have her first lovers, she's meant to be engaged to a young man of the Berry when she's still quite young, and then she breaks her engagement to marry the sculptor Clissinger, who's debt-ridden, and it starts affecting her relationship with her mother, and so with George Sand. And she, at the moment when, fast forward, Georges is in her relationship with Chopin, and at the moment when this relationship is going awry, Chopin sides with Solange in the conflict between the mother and the daughter, and that's kind of putting the nail in the coffin in the romance between Chopin and Sand. And Solange and Georges will end up refinding each other, especially through Solange's daughters. So that will be, it will be a happy ending after all, but mostly a happy ending when Solange separates from Clésinger. So to also answer your question about feminism and her view on motherhood, it's interesting how she raises her children and how her is her rapport with her daughter that was difficult.
Tempestuous.
You
read in it
whatever you want. Yes, tempestuous. Thank you. You find such wonderful adjectives. I love
it. Well, it is, in fact, my mother tongue. What can I say? That's interesting, because it also feels kind of like divine retribution. Like, Solange is a free spirit, just like Georges Sand, it sounds like, you know, and can't be contained.
Absolutely.
Whereas Maurice is a little mama's boy. No, but it sounds like she eventually had very, very mature, evolved relationships with her children.
Absolutely.
And with her grandchildren as well. So she's, I just want to emphasize that, because while she is this free spirit and all of that, she is also very careful about her family relationships, her close ones she holds close, you know. And that's, I think, often something that comes at odds with, you know, women who are constructed as free spirits in especially artists, you know. We often see them as sort of neglecting their family duties or their relationships or whatever, and we count that against them because they're women. But you can't do that for Georges Sand.
No, you can't. That's why you can't pin her down. She queers everything in that way, absolutely, because she also will put her family's needs before her own. Even in the feud with Solange, you know, she'll always be on the lookout. She doesn't diminish the female women, you know, the female figures that she has around her either. And she does the same with her friends again and partners. You know, once she loves hard, she loves deeply, and she cares. And when she was writing, even at the height of her fame and productivity, there was family life, social time, and writing time, but none of those were more important than another. She has a great work-life balance.
Yeah, yeah. Wellness warrior.
Absolutely.
God, we love to see it. Act two, the beginning and end of Georges Sand. So, she's a mother, she's been married. Does she try to get a divorce, or how does she get separated from her husband?
She gets legally separated from her husband thanks to the help of a wonderful lawyer, Michel de Bourges, with whom she has a romance, obviously. Hot. And she manages to get an official legal separation from him in 1836.
Okay, fantastic. We love that. And then she moves to Paris to mm-hmm. really kind of begin her literary career. She has literary ambitions, and she gets together with this guy, Jules, correct? Yeah. And from there, they work together on some things. They write a few things together, and they sign it as J. Sand. And that's sort of their collaborative nom de plume. And then she becomes Georges Sand on her own when she comes out with her first novel, Indiana, right?
Exactly.
In 1832.
It still happens whilst she is married. So before they're legally separated in 1836, they have a first kind of agreement with her husband that she wants to make her own money. They can't live together, so she'll be in Paris half the year doing her thing and earning her own money, and will receive a pension from her husband and her estate. And she moves in with Jules Sandeau, and they publish under J. Sand, as you said. And their first novel together is what gets her known. And then she writes Indiana on her own. And so when she wants to use the pseudonym, wants to use the same pseudonym again, but Jules Sandeau is actually quite gracious in that way and says, you should, publish it under your own name because you wrote it on your own. And so she publishes it in 1832, and it explodes. It really, Indiana and Lilia, the next one, really establish her. And it's her first phase with all her wild, normifying feminism and new ideas about women and their place in society. And there was a lot of talk when she published Indiana, was it written by a man or was it written by a woman? Who is it? She really, she shocked and appealed to audiences equally, which was beautiful to see.
She's kind of like a branding and PR genius.
Absolutely.
Very cleverly, sort of hiding behind and then letting the secret out to like play with it, for the public's sensationalism. So I think that's also really interesting. It goes back to her being a businesswoman, or a businessman. She was really canny about this stuff.
But it was discovered really quickly that it was a woman behind it. But what's interesting is that instead of, then she used it by not using it as well. She was just like, I'm who I am and screw you all. Yeah. Right. And, she didn't want to be limited by her being a woman or a man. And she kept referring to the fact that that was not the most interesting thing about her.
Yes.
She was fluid. Right. She embraced it. She was called he or she in her correspondence, in their interactions. Even her critics sometimes called her a man or a woman, or and was actually the talk of the town in that way. But she lived.
We're hunting for the queers. I think we found one. So she's really like living her fluidity. She's not she, he, they. Is not limited to female pronouns or female identity, even though it's revealed that she is, biologically female or whatever, as part of this sort of scandale. But talk to us a little bit about her wearing men's clothes and adopting this persona of Georges Sand, because yes, everybody knows that she's technically a woman under there, but people are treating her like a man in the sense that she's moving freely throughout all of these different places in society that are literally closed to women,
Absolutely. She really chose, earlier you were talking about cross-dressing versus drag, the differences, I guess the show aspect of things. Like she chose to dress as a man first and foremost because it was more practical. her tutor, Deschartres, even dressed her up as a man because it was easier to ride horses to accompany him around town, you know, around the village, sorry. And then when she moved to Paris to be a writer, she dressed as a man so that she could just move around and do what she wanted. So, and disappear in the crowd. So she didn't put on a show with her men's clothes. People called her an eccentric. She was, you know, looking for scandal. But no, she also was able, by being disguised as a man, to go to the theater, to go to the cafes, where she also was able to meet other like-minded individuals, also find inspiration for her novels, which is also what gave her that really singular voice. She talks about how much also she loved her boots as well, because at the time, the women's shoes and petticoats prevented you from just moving. She talks about the fact that you are dependent on the any hands that will help you move around, and she didn't want that. So it was really practical. Also, women's dresses were not cheap, and dressing as a man was much cheaper. But
here comes the canny businessman again. She's cutting costs, baby.
She is killing it. But totally illegally, because it was illegal for women to wear trousers until actually the 2000s, technically. So
really?
Yeah, it was, well, in France, it was in January 2013. Until January 2013, it was illegal for women to wear trousers, technically.
Wow. I guess they were just like, this one is so ridiculous, we actually don't even have time to, like, formally get rid of it.
Yeah. exactly.
Wow, that is fascinating. In the land of fashion and haute couture itself, no pants for the ladies. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I also want to just bring up quickly that she was really seen as one of the foremost writers of her day, right? I mean, the people like Flaubert and, or who's the one that hated her? Baudelaire?
Baudelaire hated her guts.
Baudelaire hated her. But you always have to have an enemy. Yeah. Anyone who's worth anything. A nemesis. But, you know, Flaubert, Hugo, all of these big, big luminaries of French literature, French romantic literature, they all esteemed her extremely highly. And I was listening to a podcast about her, and someone was talking about her style and that she writes a very lucid, clean, elegant French, very tight, very easy to read, almost like it just flows out of her brain. Absolutely. So yeah, I wonder if you have anything to add to that, just like her qualities as a writer. What's it like to read her also in French?
It was so wonderful, and hiring the fact that I had to translate it into English straight away. But to first, as she was received at the time, there's a really great text by Dostoevsky, which is called La Mort de George Sand, so George Sand's death, where he talks about her. As you said, she sold more books than Victor Hugo. She destroyed Notre Dame de Paris in terms of sales numbers. And Dostoevsky talks about her success, being more successful than Victor Hugo in his country. But also he talks about, he says that Dickens is published at the same time as George Sand in Russia, but that he is far below her in their esteem, their esteem of writers. So it's really, she is more admired than people like Hugo and Dickens. In terms of reading her, it really depends which phases of her writing you read in terms of the content, but in the form, she manages to make you dive into both the character's psyche and their environment without ever feeling like there is an imbalance between the two. A lot of people called her a romantic, and technically she was part of romanticism as well, but she's also one of the first realists. And is in line with the Stendhal and the Balzacs and later on the Flauberts of the time. She really pictures it as it is, and it's such a unique voice of the time that I guess you only find in men, because it was also found that there was female writing and there was male writing, and she always said, "I'm not a woman who writes, I'm a writer," and she has a really unique voice in that way.
Yeah. That's interesting. Right. So that's kind of like the evolution. You get the realist writers as well. And Balzac also really liked her, right? So there's this quote from Alexandre Dumas, who's another writer of the period, where he says, "George Sand, that hermaphroditic genius, good start, who gathers a man's vigor and a woman's grace, who, like a sphinx, a living and mysterious enigma, sits on the extreme limits of art with the face of a lady, the claws of a lion, the wings of an eagle. I mean, intense, but I think like it's so immediately apparent in that quote, the chimerical nature, you know, she's a composite of different things. She's man, she's woman, she's hermaphrodite, she's other, she's sphinx, she's lion, eagle, lady. Like, I think it's a very interesting encapsulation of how she appeared as all of these things at once, or was able to dial them up or down.
Absolutely. And it also reveals that people are so intrigued. They don't know what to make of her. Mm. And she, in that way, is super queer again, because she is defying all the labels, all the boxes. And people are like, ah, who are you? And it fascinates them. It disgusts them. That's why she's making so much ink run, as we say in French. That's why people write about her, to praise her, to criticize her, because she is all these things. The claws of a lion, the wings of an eagle. She's an enigma.
She also becomes political, in the period in the 1840s, is it, when it's becoming more of a liberal monarchy. There's obviously like a lot of economic hardship for the lower and working classes, because this is of course also the century of industrialization. Mm-hmm. Like we said, she sort of becomes a little champagne socialist. She's certainly not living the life of the workers, but she really sympathizes with them. That's not fair. Not champagne socialist. She does a lot of writing and a lot of activism from what I understood. She writes articles for the Figaro. She launches her own publication, and after the revolution of 1848 is even acting as minister for propaganda, or serving the minister for propaganda in the government.
Yeah, she's helping the ministre de l'Intérieur to rule things, basically, and she's really trying to advocate for equality of rights and for workers' rights. There are quite a few caricatures of her being behind him, kind of hiding and whispering in his ear, you know. But she started quite a few papers, a few reviews, a few newspapers, just advocating for what she believed in, so equality, workers' rights, and always for the Republic. So when it was there, fighting for it, and when it was not there, fighting for its return.
Right. And when you say reviews, you mean like magazines, newspapers?
Yeah, they call it La Revue, right? Which is
La Revue, yeah.
Which is a synonym for newspaper.
Yeah. So, and that will also clearly impact her later writing as well, because she becomes sort of disillusioned after the period of the Second Republic and then the Second Empire taking over, and she moves out to the family estate in Nohant, where she begins, it sounds like, writing more her pastoral works, her works that are about people in the countryside. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that and how that was related to her politics.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because I think you summarized it perfectly. She was quite disillusioned. She did spend a lot of time in Nohant. She needed to recharge in the country very regularly, no matter how much she loved Paris, because, you know, she was in salons all the time and all over the place, meeting with the great brains of the time. And then she has this thing in the second half of the 1840s where she writes three novels that are much more rustic. And actually what happens is, after having had these big novels about independent women, rethinking what love is, she decides to, after, I guess, straightening up the reputation of women and showing that they are actually able and not passive, she writes La Mare au Diable and François Le Champy and La Petite Fadette, which are three novels with which she wants to show the real side of country life. Often farmers are mocked in literature at this point, of course not everywhere, but they are, the figure of the farmer is always humorous or seen as, you know, more lazy, uneducated. And with these three novels, she really dives into the the people that she grew up with, we go back to her education having made her who she was, she goes back to, she shows the world, and she shows France that the countryside is not necessarily what people think, that these that they are clever, that they are also active and wonderful people. And actually, surprisingly, or maybe not so, these are the three novels that are the most studied at school. These are the ones that I knew. I didn't know her earlier works when growing up in France.
We could talk forever about her as a writer and as an activist and all these other things. We need to talk about her as a sexual being as well. We want to get some of the dirt, because the other side of this is that George Sand was an absolute fixture of the gossip rags, right? She was constantly mm-hmm. talked about. She was constantly getting into relationships and affairs with liaison with all of these, you know, high profile guys, Alfred de Musset, Frédéric Chopin, all of these very well known artists. Although she did not limit herself to artists, from what I understand, she also mm-hmm. went after lawyers and doctors and journalists. So I wonder if you'll just read us this quick quote about her that appeared in Le Figaro, which is the same newspaper that still exists today, right? It's like a 200-year-old newspaper.
Yeah, but at the time it was much more seen as a satirical newspaper. Is that how you say it? You know, places where it was way more critical than today, where today is quite perceived as like center-right-wing newspaper.
Okay, so this is how the out-there lefty newspaper describes our heroine.
George Sand, he or she, an enigma. They say that she writes books and that he smokes, that she left her husband and that he, this woman, drinks rum and punch. They maintain that she shaves her face. She requires her male lovers to call her sir and her female lovers, in the midst of the sweetest hugging and kissing, to call her miss.
I mean, let's do a little close reading of this quote real quick. I love how they are playing with the pronouns, you know, like mm-hmm. obviously Georges Sand's gender identity was something to really unpack and pick through. And it was extremely non-normative for this figure to sort of encapsulate both a masculine and a feminine presence or identity or whatever. And then I also love that they sort of just mention male lovers as if that's the norm, and then they clarify that with her female lovers she's in the midst of the sweetest hugging and kissing. Because of course we can't imagine women actually having sex with women. They're just doing little sweet hugs and kisses to one another.
I had never thought of that. Oh my god. I was like, why did I thought it was just, you know, just wanting to have a bit more of a closer look of what women do together. But no, you're right, it's actually quite diminishing what happens for girl on girl action.
There's something uneven there, or they're trying to really like call attention to the fact that she might be in these female relations by giving it a little more color. But but no, I think this is such an interesting little quote. And so she did have affairs with some of these big guys, Chopin, Musset. Talk to us a little bit about those. The one with Chopin was kind of one of the biggest ones, right?
Well, Musset and Chopin are really like the two biggest ones. And what's interesting is that I'd say equally and very differently. So Musset, it feels like Musset occupies, if anything, the first part of her life, and Chopin somehow the second part, even though... And then there's Manso at the end of her life. So you have kind of like the three big male loves of her life. Musset was an earlier one, and it was very passionate and burning, and it has some of the sauciest letters ever written in 19th century literature. And they were the steamiest couple in town. And then they went to Venice on a romantic trip, and everything crumbled down. They became ill one after the other, and George had an affair with the doctor, and it all ended up in a lot of tears. So I think this is, if anything, this is her fire relationship. I don't know if we all have that in our lives. You know, we all had this kind of devouring, passionate romance that we thought was the one and that just destroyed us from the inside. But still, we kept going back to it. That was very much that for a while. She even wrote later on in her life, even after she broke up with Chopin. She published Elle et lui, which is based largely on her relationship with Musset. And he replied, publishing Lui et Elle, trying to straighten up the facts. And they had a big back and forth in the press. So that stayed on for quite a while. But they also, you know, they slept around, and it was known that they slept around. But I think for Venice, it was just they were both quite miserable, and it just was not the romantic trip it was meant to be. And then Chopin, Georges Sand, it has to be said, was very close to Franz Liszt, who was another big composer of the time, and Marie Dagou, his lover / partner, and they traveled around a lot together, and Chopin was one of their close friends. And the first time that Chopin met Sand, he was not impressed and thought that she was mannish and rude and loud. And
poor little gentle Chopin can't handle.
Yes, right. But it's you know, poor little gentle Chopin is so true, because he was he's described always as sickly and unwell. And when they started their romance, George very much took care of him as a child, and talks about herself as being his mother quite a lot. And they had a very different relationship to the tempestuous Musset one, where they stayed together for quite a long time, quite a few years. And Chopin was constantly sick, and George was trying to accommodate him. But they did go around together, and he was there. It seemed like it was a much more calm relationship. But then, and it's the time when I wrote about in my play, they, quite at the beginning of their relationship, they went to Mallorca for the winter, thinking that it was going to do Chopin good for his health. And then it didn't turn out to be the idyllic trip at all, and Chopin became even more ill. And they came back and had to stay in Marseille for 4 months for Chopin to regain strength. And then it kind of happened, you know, this kind of traveling romance kept going on, and they talked about music a lot. She was very learned in music as well, and they talked about work a lot. When they were in Mallorca, for example, Chopin composed a lot of his most famous works, including the Preludes. It seems that it was a very prolific time for both of them when they were together, and that they inspired and supported each other a lot.
And but they are like having a real affair, like they're doing sex on each other, right?
Yes.
I just kind of, so everything you just said, I'm like, I can't imagine Chopin.
It's
like, was
so
he
true.
The bottom?
You know what? He might have been. Because it's like, I think she also toes this line between being platonic lovers and actual sex active lovers. It's not always super clear. And with Chopin, I wonder, there's a film with Hugh Grant actually playing Chopin quite, I think, accurately, where romance feels very asexual. I wonder what was happening in the bedroom. It's interesting.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a good segue, actually, the line between platonic and passionate, because the other affair that interests us on this queer hunting podcast is with Marie Dorval, who is an actress of the Parisian stage. They meet in the early 1830s. And then all of these people start warning Georges Sand about Dorval, saying that she's a lesbian. And then I think they're also worried for Marie Dorval, that Georges Sand is sort of like this oversexed, sapphic, you know, crusader. So we've got some very funny quotes here that we could go through. But give us a little bit of the resume. Were they in a real sort of passionate relationship? Were they stupping? Who was stupping whomst? Who was pegging whomst? What happened there?
Again, a little bit like what we said about Chopin. It is ambiguous. Also, we suspect that a lot of that correspondence was destroyed. So it's still very up in the air. And some people call them lovers. Some, when I say people, like researchers call them lovers. Others talk about their good friendship, you know.
Of course. The classic historian's way of speaking about any lesbian.
Exactly. But I think when you read their correspondence, they talk to each other like lovers, and they really, Georges Sand writes to Marie incredibly passionate letters where she is the male lover. She presents herself as this, you know, passionate male lover, where Marie Dorval is the female lover, whatever that means. I don't know if they were reproducing heteronormative vibes in their dynamic. I don't know. But they express their love to each other and their attraction to each other a lot in their letters. Or could be interpreted as friendship, or could also be interpreted as non-so platonic. The fact that Alfred de Vigny, who was Marie Dorval's lover, has written in the margin of one of her letters, "I forbade Marie to reply to this Sappho who is harassing her," makes me think that, you know, George Sand's being... It was quite explicit at the time. When they met, so George Sand saw Marie on stage and wrote her a little note saying how much she loved and adored her. And then Marie Dorval arrived in George Sand's flat the next morning saying
typical lesbian, right? Is just like, I saw you in one play and we're moving in together.
And you're gonna need a U-Haul.
Yeah, exactly. And we're getting married. Yes, they were. Yeah, and that fire kept on going. And the way Sand talks about her in her autobiography is, again, non-explicitly lesbian, and I wonder if it's, you know, an assumption on our part or at the time, you know, that she couldn't really talk about these things no matter how free she was. But there is, she respected Marie so much, and she talks about her in the way that she doesn't talk about other people.
And they stayed friends into the 1840s.
Yeah, they did until Dorval passed away, and that's described as really, really heartbreaking. But they have also this, Georges wrote to Dorval this really, really steamy thing once, which makes me think, you know, it's between tenderness and sex, but she says, "The theatre or in your bed, I simply must come and kiss you, my lady, or I shall do something crazy." So until the end, she behaves as her passionate lover, heartbroken lover.
Just like they said in Le Figaro, all of that sweet hugging and kissing. These darned lesbians. They're always hugging and kissing one another. All right. Well, I think I want to believe that she is, she has the capacity to be as queer as we want her to be. So I call her a lesbian. I call her a bisexual. I think she was probably fooling around with some hot ladies in Paris.
Honestly, in the play, I made her that. She is having, and I think she really is paving the way to polyamory in a beautiful way. Like, it was so fluid, and, you know, nobody was jealous about really other people. With Musset, it was a bit more complicated, but she still did whatever she wanted, and she understood that it didn't matter. I think she's a pioneer for openness and for, like, beautiful bisexual freedom.
Gorgeous. Okay, well, I couldn't say it better than that. So let's leave it there for Georges Sand. She did live a long, lovely life in the end in the country, making her jams and writing and looking after her grandchildren and all these beautiful things, bathing in the river nearby until she was like 80 or some, or 70 or something. So she really, she lived a good life. She did well.
She really did.
So thank you, Georges Sand, for being so fucking hot and cool. Now, in our last segment, I want to talk a little bit about a question that we always ask, which is, does anyone give a shit? So we were talking about how Georges Sand died eventually, which is great. Well, not great. We're sad for her. But she was 71 years old. She was living in her family estate in Noyon, which is in what part of France again? It's
southwest of Paris.
Southwest of Paris.
Like, just south, a bit west, below Orléans.
So, but now that our heroine has died, the question, of course, becomes, does anyone care? And I think the answer is clear that we both do care, but why? And actually, the answer is not so much, is not so clear for everyone else in the world, the lay people, because it seems like, you know, given her stature during her life, she doesn't really enjoy the same kind of renown, the same kind of legacy that some of her male counterparts do. I'm thinking, you know, some of the other realist writers or romantic writers of the 19th century. I actually came across a, I think, review of a biography of her that was written for the New York Times Book Review. And I'm going to use that to quote a little bit, because it was a really nicely written article, number one. It's written in the year 2000, so it's out of copyright. It's completely it's completely okay for me to plagiarize from this. But written by someone named Belinda Jack, who I think wrote a biography of her. So first of all, let's talk about her her legacy sort of as one of these proto-feminists, as one of as a liberated woman, because it was complicated. It wasn't an easy legacy necessarily at the time of her death, because women were still not really emancipated. So Belinda, in her article for the New York Times Book Review, says, George Sand is France's most famous 19th century woman writer, but she is best known as the famous lover of the celebrated Chopin, and variously described not in relation to her writing, but rather as a frigid bisexual nymphomaniac or the good lady of Nohant. So how do you react to that?
Well, surprisingly / not surprisingly, when diving back into her life, you know, that's very much the duality that I had in my mind. I knew she was kind of a badass, dressing as a man, sleeping with people. That's kind of like how what I had retained, you know, as a French former pupil in the French education system. So she was that on one hand, but also all the books that I had read by her or studied by her, which were just two, were La Mare au Diable and La Petite Fadette, extracts from that, which we talked about. And these were, you know, not exciting for me as, you know, pastoral novels. I barely remembered what it was about. I just remembered being like interested, but it didn't seem to be correlating with this image that I had of her. And I think this is representative of what Belinda Jack is saying, you know, that she's remembered, but for these elements, and
for her relationship elements. She's remembered more of that.
Yeah, she's remembered more for her morality, her scandalous part, and only bits of her scandalous being, you know, being dressed as a man and having dated famous intellectuals and probably being a bit queer, but not without really that having been proven, or being, you know, someone who was the good mother and good representative of the countryside. And I think she was so much more than that, what I found interesting was in rediving in her biography was understanding what linked all of that and understanding who she was underneath, which we've explored together. And it's interesting because that's probably representative of what happened in her days, in the sense that at the time, already a woman who wrote, who dressed as a man and who didn't care what people thought, really, was talked about more for her morality than for her work, even though she sold more books than Victor Hugo, Balzac, etc. So I'm not surprised that she's remembered as that, but that's kind of our duty when putting her back on at the front of the stage. It's kind of our duty to be like, okay, let's dive into her complexities as a human being.
So how would you describe those? You know that stupid thing where people are like, if your friends could describe you in three words or something like that, what would they be? Hot, rich, but what would they be for George Sand? Because it seems like you've spent a lot of time trying to access who this woman was in reality, who she was beyond her reputation as a writer, beyond her reputation as a frigid bisexual nymphomaniac. I don't understand the frigid part of that, really. She doesn't seem...
It's so paradoxical, right? Because people are like, oh, she was too sexually liberated, but she was also frigid. It's just some of her heroines sometimes, in the way they present themselves, didn't necessarily correspond to how women were perceived at the time. But actually, so I'm thinking of Lilia, where some people said, oh, you know, she pictured this frigid woman who won't marry this man unless he sorts himself out, which is great. She's reversing the female protagonist's kind that we've had before. And she's just introducing us to this woman who
decides to marry a man on her own terms, that she's not the one who's going to have to improve to marry, but he's going to have to meet her moral standards and her intellectual standards, which I think is incredible. But also some people saw at the time as frigid, just because, you know, being no fun and complicated and just not a woman who would just give herself easily. And that is, you know, so it was like, so there was so much labeling going on. It was like people were taking these tiny strings of you know, strands of her life and making it a big headline. It's the tabloids of the time.
I mean, that's a pretty classic, that's a pretty tale as old as time, I think, with with men and women. If you don't want to have sex with them, you're a frigid bitch. If you want to have sex with them, you're a whore. Exactly. I mean, you just can't win in any century.
God forbid I exude confidence and enjoy sex.
So what are those three words that you would use to describe Jocelyne? Not to put you on the spot.
Yeah. But. No, I mean, I think this is an amazing question. I'd say definitely queer. She's, but we've talked about this, but she's queer for me in so many ways, even though she didn't have the vocabulary, this vocabulary at her disposal at the time. Now I can't but use that word. Forward thinking, she has this incredible, Balzac talks about an interaction that he had with her where he went to visit her in Nouan, and he describes his camarade Sand by the fire, and he says that she told him that through what, he quotes her saying, through what we write, we prepare a revolution for future generations. So I think in that sense, and she moves on to saying, this generation is basically not ready for this revolution, but she was already trusting how forward thinking her work was going to be, which may be pretentious, but also she understood her time so well, I think. So queer,
I don't think you're ready for this jelly. I don't think you're ready for this jelly. That is Georges Sand's, you know, on Instagram, when you have to choose a song to go with the post, that's hers.
I'm definitely stealing that. I will be tagging you. But then the fourth thing is one word, I guess. And then third word, I think love. Loving, love something. Because I want to say romantic, but I would associate her with the literary movement. So she was love. And I think I talk in my play about an episode of her life that must have been quite difficult, and I want more queer joy. But what I do adore about this woman is how when she loved hard, like we talked about. And
yeah,
she loved her work. She loved her work, took care of the people who were around her, and really cared about what she was doing as a mom, as a friend, as a partner. And yeah, love. So queer, forward thinking, and love.
I love that. That's beautiful. Something we can all aspire to. I want to dive in. I want to dig in a little more just before we wrap it up into queer, because I think I know what you mean, but I want to hear more about what you mean and how you came to that word and that conclusion. Yeah. I was listening to a podcast about her, and one of the academics who studies her said that Georges Sand really believed that identity was liable to change regularly, that the self was made up of many potential selves. And I think that's such a modern and actually very queer way of looking at the self as consisting of many selves, of many different layers of, you know, I mean, and people are assholes and I think poke fun at this all the time, but there are, you know, some people who identify as like female one day and male the next day. Like, I think that kind of chameleon changeability is very queer. So that jumps out to me when you chose that as your first word. But I want to hear more about how you came to that conclusion and any like really striking tidbits about her that really solidified that conception of her for you.
Well, when I say queer, I mean, I love what you just said, and it's so representative of her. And she was so complex. That's also why so much was written about her. People couldn't figure her out. But she really, for me, she lived queerly in the very original sense of the word, you know, oddly, non-straightly, away from the norm. She completely exploded the codes. She defied gender norms. She defied the narratives around gender and sexuality, even though it's, you know, a belief from accumulated research, but still. She was super sexually liberated. in the sense that
work.
She because she had she had multiple lovers and was not afraid of being sensual, which already was queering the vision of women at the time. Her homosexuality is, you know, it's she was allegedly homosexual, but I am just saying that she is, and I will stand by it. She dressed as a man, so queer gender norms and gender expectations. She had a man pen name, was known after her first novel to be a woman, and still didn't care about how she presented in the world. And you know this quote that we read about her male lovers calling her sir and her female lovers calling her miss, or like female lovers calling her sir, sorry, and male lover miss. It's she didn't really care in the write in the her correspondence, in her writing. You understand that she uses pronouns very fluently, and even in her correspondence with Marie Dorval, she is a he, she is a she, she is undefinable like that. And and then finally also in her work about the different selves that you were talking about, you know, she fucked off to Paris to earn her own money. And that would have been deemed quite queer at the time, in the original sense, quite weird, strange.
For a respectable woman.
Absolutely.
Right. I love that. Okay, well, George Sand, the freak. You heard it here first.
The freak.
The absolute freak in the sheets and the streets. So let's wrap it up with a little bit about your experience playing her, because that is actually why we sort of conceived this episode, is the writing of your play, which is being represented in June in London, which is super exciting. I'm curious about, you know, what you've learned from that experience of kind of resurrecting one of our queer ancestors, breathing life into her, inhabiting her. I'm not an actor, so I don't know what that experience is like at all. But I, as someone who studies queer history, I frequently feel myself having to think along those lines of like, what would this person have actually have thought, or what would they have experienced? And because so much of that is lost to us, right? So much of that doesn't exist. Yeah. It's not recorded. It wasn't allowed to be preserved. So for whatever reason, we can't access it. So tell me a little bit about your experience doing that, coping with that, and seeing it through into a real production.
It's an incredible question, because it's been quite a long, long process. And I can't engage with it. I engaged with it as a writer first, but in mind the idea of playing her. As a writer first, I had to find, you know, an angle. There was so much I wanted to say. And then I had to come to terms with the fact that whatever voice I was going to give her was not going to be exactly her voice, but was going to be my interpretation of her voice. The very first residency kind of R&D little bit that we did in January 2022, we had a panel. I decided to just bring more brains in the room. We had a panel, and it was on gender and identity, and then another panel on period drama, modern play, and really kind of leaning into that. How much do you choose to say? So I'm very aware that George, which is the title of my play, is taking a stance, is taking one aspect of her life and reinventing also what could have happened, and taking this opportunity to throw in all the mysteries around her and just kind of saying, you know, yep, I'm assuming she was a homosexual. I'm assuming that she was loving hard. I'm assuming that she had flaws that I am inferring from her writing and from all the things that I've written about her. It was really hard to just embrace choosing a voice for her. But when I wrote this, and I have found this playing her, I wanted a character who was smart and who was genuine and who was strong and who defined their own self and their own sexuality, their own life, without being defined by a man or the norms or constrained by gender normativity, and finding her as a character, as a person who has actually existed, was such a a solace. Like, it was incredible to get to play her. And also in the play, in George, I get to play her character, Gabriel. So George is about her writing Gabriel and the solace that she found in that. So I think I can't answer this question without talking about that, meaning that in my play, she plays her own, we see her play her own character, inhabiting right. this character who is showing the world that one can be in whatever way they want, and exploring the complexities of that in her time and recontextualizing that was so heartbreaking and freeing, and just made me want to fight even more for our right to be ourselves. Going through her journey of her caring so much about a project as well makes me find a parallel with how I'm feeling about the play as well. You know, I'm like, I really care about this and I want it to be put on. And any artist or anyone who creates anything, who puts themselves out there, finds a kinship in that.
Yeah, yeah. That's wonderful. And I love that you made her queer, by the way. And you know, just so everyone knows, we're it's not exactly like Leia was going out on a limb here. I mean, we have letters from her supposedly just friend saying, oh my God, I need you to kiss me so badly, or whatever the fuck she says in her letters. It's like,
yeah,
yeah, it's not really that big of a leap to no.
she is a historical homo. She is absolutely.
She is a historical homo.
She is a historical gay.
And so often you have to act like that is a choice or posturing or whatever. And I think when we're dealing with queer people in history, but it's like, you know what? It's just the same thing to say that they're straight. Like we have an equal right. I mean, I went and I saw this incredible, hilarious play last weekend called Oh Mary. And it's about Mary Todd Lincoln, who was the wife of President Abraham Lincoln, who is reputed to have had homosexual relationships with multiple men throughout his life. And he was also married to this like hideous bull of a woman named Mary Todd Lincoln. So, you know, she doesn't exactly not scream beard, but they just super embraced the fact that Abraham Lincoln was gay in the play. And I thought it was great because there wasn't even a question about it. You know, it was not, they didn't problematize it. You know, they just, and it was a farce and it's a comedy and all that. So, and gay people are funnier than straight people. So, you know, there's reasons they made that choice, I'm sure. But I thought that was such a great example of, you know, you make the choice and you just go with it because of course you're allowed to make that choice.
And I didn't want to also, at first, when I approached this a bit as an academic, I was like, oh, I'm going to get so many George Sound specialists on my back. Yeah. But then I was like, but wait.
All three this of is, them.
Well, you'd be surprised. I think she obsesses more. But that's the thing. She obsesses more people than we know. Anyway. Yeah. But I was also like, this is also me taking a stance and just, I'm not here to write a thesis and to show how much research I've done. I have done it, and now this interpretation I have, I'm just like, she is just gay, and she's just gonna be, and she's just gonna have this lesbian lover, and they're just gonna talk about the fact that she is seeing this woman whilst also being with Chopin, and it's not gonna be addressed as an education in polyamory to the audience. It's just going to be queerness as she was, because she just had this queer aspect to her, and I thought, I'm just gonna take this stance from what I have.
All right, well, we could go on and on with this because we're two people very passionate about it. Thank you so much, Leia, for we do a little segment called A Straight Apology.
It's a straight apology.
Typically, my sister, who is often my co-host on this show, comes on and apologizes for something that a straight person has done in history. And there's a lot to apologize for. I am going to take that over just because I have a slightly relevant one. So this is a straight apology for the Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte, who, you know, whatever, like whatever. Napoleon, we could say so much. There's a lot of history there. I don't even know half of it. What I do know is that Ridley Scott's new Napoleon movie was such a giant steaming turd. I was so excited for it. I was so excited for it. And I mean, speaking of, like, you know, history being represented and all of that, and Ridley Scott, like Gladiator, you know, we're all waiting for the next Gladiator. Although I guess that's going to be Gladiator 2, which with Paul Mescal, which is just waiting for me to masturbate to it. But I do feel that I need to apologize on behalf of Napoleon Bonaparte and Ridley Scott for delivering a film that just bored me to tears. I could not stay awake for most of it. And I actually don't think that Napoleon is like the... I'm so sick of stories that are... stories about megalomaniac men who are seen as the great heroes of history, even though all they're doing is leading armies to murder people, like in new... I mean, this is the same problem I have with the new Alexander documentary on Netflix and the way that people talk about Alexander the Great in general. As some kind of like noble military genius, it's like he was invading all of these different places in the world that were perfectly fine, by the way, mm-hmm. and did not need liberation and just killing people left and right. Like, that's a megalomaniac psychopath killer. That's not a genius. So on behalf of Napoleon, I apologize to queer kind for everything that I have done, which is everything that Napoleon has done, which is not only killing a ton of people in the 19th century, but also living a life that resulted in the most recent Ridley Scott steaming pile of shit film.
Bravo.
And any reactions?
Gorgeous. I mean, and thank you for sharing your thoughts on this, because yeah, like the invasion aspect, just glorifying men who crushed everything, including the women in their country, you know, the Napoleonic code that we talked about to start with. I'm like, well, Napoleon can also apologize for ruining Georgetown's life just as she was coming into the world. So yeah.
Yes, that is also the thing that I wanted to say in my straight apology. God damn it, I forgot. But I remembered that he made divorce illegal, right? The Napoleonic Code made divorce illegal and made women legal minors. The one thing we do have to thank Napoleon for, though, the code for, is decriminalizing sodomy. Because that did happen. So, you know what?
Okay, he did some good things for the homos, so well done.
Golf clap.
Thank you.
Golf clap for Napoleon. All right. Thank you so much, Leia, for joining us. This was awesome. It was so great to learn about the work that you've done, and congratulations on your play. And everybody go see it who's in London this June.
Yes. It will be on at the Omnibus from the end of June till mid-July and for their Pride Month festival. And can't wait to share it with you all. Thank you so much for having me and for diving into the crazy months of research that I've done on Georgetown. I hope that it will also prompt people's wanting to know more about her and her great work. And yeah, thank you for everything.
Fabulous. Merci beaucoup.
Merci.
Thanks for joining us this week. If you like what you hear, give us a little 5-star rating on Apple or Spotify. Yeah, that's right. Just like that. Mommy likes when you listen. Oh, and follow us at historical.homos on Instagram, at historicalhomos on TikTok. Sign up for more updates on our website at historicalhomos.com. And just be gay. Be happy. But be gay mostly. Love you. Bye.